You're listening to episode 78 of the Ubuntu People's Podcast, a conversation with Mr. Omar Aviles. Omar was born in Chicago, Illinois. He spent his formative years in one of the more dangerous parts of the city. In fact, it was a violent incident with one of his older brothers that prompted Omar's mother to get the whole family on a bus to North Carolina. Omar has been in North Carolina, middle school, high school, and college. He was a member of one of the most historic soccer teams in North Carolina high school sports. A book was written about their adventures. We talk about living in the Bible Belt as a Mexican-American, a very proud Mexican-American, the different peoples and attitudes that he's had to deal with. Omar has been in Hollywood for the past 3.5 years, trying to make it in front and behind the camera. We talk about the business as both talent and creator. We talk about his ambitions in an industry that is going through significant change and what he plans to do in the midst of all of that change and in creating some himself. If you like the content that you hear on the Ubuntu People's Podcast, click the like button and certainly subscribe to our SoundCloud feed. Old episodes could also be found on iTunes, Apple Podcasts. We pick up the story with Omar talking about his first few years in the city of Chicago. Sit back and enjoy. And this is what years are we talking about?
This is about 95 to 99, 2000. We grew up in Cicero, which is Al Capone, the Italian mobster's town, okay. Right? Once an Italian immigrant town in the mid-90s, Latino immigrant town. Definitely a lot of gang violence. You'd always see something, you know? Mom was very aware of that, always just come straight back. Don't make friends with these guys. They're going to want to talk to you. And there was definitely some of that teasing, you know? You're 6, 7 years old and they're already looking at you like a scout. I've got a good scar that, you know, walking back from in an alley and just getting jumped. The last thing I see, I hit a corner of a garage from somebody slamming my head into it, falling back, and mom somehow just had this reaction to go find me. Next thing I know, I'm like riding with mom and getting stitched up. So little things like that.
How old were you?
6, probably going on 7, something like that, yeah.
How did that in any way cloud or influence your judgment of the city as a whole?
I tell this story about getting jumped, but at the same time, we were playing hide and go seek the next day, having that very innocent fun and running around. You learn to not involve yourself or to be able to wall things off in your mind and separate them, and you just hope that that doesn't come and cross your path. A lot of people look at Chicago from the outside and go, oh, you just step in and somebody's going to start doing things. But really, it comes down to your involvement and the paths you walk, and do those paths cross interest with the other things that are going on, like maybe some organized crime, etc. Even at the park, they're playing basketball over there. You could feel that tension that they're about to get into a big fight or something's going to go down. But you're focused on the swings and playing with the other kids. You learn to live with that, and I think that, in a way, makes you more dynamic. That's as a 6, 7-year-old, right?
I mean, that's what I find remarkable is that, I mean, I was born in the Caribbean, but grew up, for the most part, from age 9 to 18 in New York City. And so there is this, I don't want to say sixth sense, but you just pick up on it. Because there's so much going on, there's so many people. To survive and navigate your way, it just comes to you almost. Did you get that sense in Chicago? And do you go back now as an adult? What do you see now that you perhaps didn't see when you were 6 or 7?
I definitely see that there's an ongoing spirit from the Italian immigrant crime that happens to the whole Latino, specifically Mexican. That's the biggest community that we have there. Organized crime between gangs, etc. It's almost like Al Capone's spirit's still there, but he's Mexican now. Now that I'm older and I can see patterns and understand, you know, socioeconomics or demographics a little better, it becomes more about the reasoning and the reactions from individuals and communities to certain things. It's not as immediate of a response like I would maybe try to find when I was younger. And I could point to one person that said something or a group of people like the Cholos, you know?
Do we have it wrong in general, the national perspective on Chicago? Let me phrase it another way. The primary, I think, mental and emotional connection is the violence. Is the guns, is all that. But what we don't recognize is maybe the art or any other cultural movements that are coming out of it. What are we missing about Chicago?
I can explain it maybe through another example. I felt like I had to be a lawyer or a doctor to be successful until I had intro to jazz in community college the first year. I didn't believe in art before that, but for the first time in my life, I heard about music and art coming from a place of suffrage, and how Miles would come out and just play that horn to sound out the things that were going on in his home. I could relate with that, and I fell in love with art at that point. I could believe in it. I could see, oh, that's it. I have so much to share, not even in the way that others can see and feed from yet. I wasn't even aware that wasn't on my radar. It was more so just me purely reacting to seeing how magic can come from that and being able to be part of that or wanting to be part of that.
The community college stuff happened in North Carolina?
It happened in North Carolina.
It happened in North Carolina. When did you move from Chicago to North Carolina? Where in North Carolina?
It would have been 99 to 2000. I think it was just right around the turn of the year. I have two older brothers, and they came back pretty bloody one day from some gangsters on the street saying something, and my brother said something back, so they just, you know, figured they'd teach him a lesson. Mom, I think, as I recall, decided to go, well, they keep running into this, or we could just go somewhere else. Mm. Where could that be? So she, you know, we had one family member that lived out here, and she decided that was it. She got on a Greyhound, and I remember getting on a bus with Mom, and we start seeing cows and pointing at every single cow that we see off the highway, and oh, we saw a deer, oh my goodness, you know, just that being super excited and just coming out to the openness, you know.
I turn to his four, four into his six. You're gonna keep on mucking around your friend, boy, he's gonna get you. Been your son on a trick, but I'm crying, baby. Honey, don't you want to go? Back to the land of California.
And so you get to North Carolina, 11, 12 years old is what, 7th, 8th grade or somewhere around there? Middle school?
5th or 6th, yeah.
So what was that experience like that first year? Because you're now adjusting again.
Yeah, so I go to a predominantly Hispanic school. There were enough Latinos for me to feel like I could teach something from someone that came from a big communal, cholo community. And these kids were trying to be tough. And I was like, well, I know what tough is, right? It's like, well, I can share sort of how you really do this. And I was just an angry little fifth grader, you know.
How to really be a bad guy from what you learned in Chicago?
I wasn't involved in any of it there, you know, so it was that was interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
Coming from a place where you knew the consequences of it, you knew the feeling that it engendered in you, having your head shoved against a garage.
A garage corner, yeah.
And then your brother coming home, blood, and your mom saying, we don't want any of this. But that's interesting. Your first reaction is to not perpetrate it, but you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah,
kind of. But maybe it's not interesting. This was a powerful way of existing where you were in Chicago. Why not establish that dominance right away?
And it was welcomed. The idea of what a cholo or a gangster was something that not just the Latinos in the middle school, but almost in general, everybody thought was cool. It's cool. It's bad. It's like you said, it's a way to kind of assert dominance very quickly or to establish that you are or that you think you are, you know?
Was it mostly intra? So Latina versus Latina, or was this letting the white population in the area know?
Yeah, I remember there were kids who are now some of my best friends who were like, dude, you're mean. I remember you being on the soccer field and looking me straight in the eye in a way that was scary and saying that you'd beat me up if I pushed you again. And now I laugh about it, but I try to remember back to that. And I feel bad now. I was trying to create a sort of a defense sphere to just don't fuck with me and to see if I could, as a survivalist, as someone who had already lived in Chicago, I think I was trying to get ahead of some reactions that I thought might come because these country folk, they're kind of slow. And not slow in the sense of academically, they were all faster than me, you know? but in the sense of wit and that, you know, like I said, that rhythm that you really catch on to in bigger cities.
At what point did you go, this isn't working for me because it's not true to who I am?
What goes up must come down. Spinning wheel got to go round. Troubles, it's a crying sin. Ride a painted pony, let the spinning wheel spin. You got no money.
So that's interesting. I flunked the fifth grade. I flunked the fifth grade, not because I had bad grades, but because I was in ISS over 80% of my attendance in school suspension. So technically I wasn't there, but I'd been in a room.
So what is going on? What are you doing here? Yeah. What are you doing for in school? So you're mean mugging people. Are you pushing? Are you shoving? Are you the bully? What is going on?
I was going to ISS more for getting bored in class, doing my assignment, and start talking to the person to my right. or I would start trying to be funny to distract somebody. That was probably like 90% of what got me in ISS. It wasn't even me like cursing at someone or anything like that. I definitely had moments, but it was mostly just distracting the class and being a clown and wanting to not follow instruction, honestly.
Was there any like an attention deficit diagnosis that anybody ever try to steer your mom towards that direction and medication and things like that?
Yeah, actually not until I was at UNC Chapel Hill as a 20-year-old.
Okay.
Was that a direction. My mom may have had a clue, but she always reinforced, we are who we are, figure out how to use it. I knew I was different in that sense. I'm hyperactive, absolutely, and I see that as an ability. If mm-hmm. you know, if you choose to make it, obviously it has its difficulties. I'm not taken away from that and saying like that's non-existent, absolutely. But at the time, I knew it was a little bit different, and I guess that was my way of projecting that, of being like, okay, I've done this, I've done it, boom, I'm done. What else do we do? You know, what else can I get my hands in? What can I move around, and who can I talk to? Without considering that somebody's trying really hard to finish their assignment.
Right.
Yeah.
Middle school, high school, what were grades like, and what is mom saying along this point? If there's like ISS and there's other things that are popping up, is she on you like you're the devil? What the hell is wrong with you? Or is she just understanding? When you come home after these things, what is it like there?
Well, she would keep it really real. She would say, you know, I work really hard. You see how I look when I get back home and how tired I am.
What kind of what did she do?
She's mostly done housekeeping and done a lot of maintenance or worked for bed and breakfasts, things like that. She would just be like, I'm the example of what you need to grow beyond. You want to do this? Okay, keep going back there and doing that. But you're going to feel the consequences and you're going to live with that. She always was very much a realist in that way. Backtracking a little bit to, and going along with what you're asking is, not intentionally, but the following year after I flunked, we moved to the even further into the country. And then I went to Silk Hope. This is a predominantly white school. It's just a bunch of little country boys and, you know, country girls. And the difference from that was that for the first time, you know, where in Chatham Middle, education wasn't something that anybody revered or anybody really made cool or made something that was possible. You had to choose sides, I felt. Very much more in Chicago. Once you choose a side, you can't jump back and forth.
Either you're going to be cool or you're going to be a school guy.
That's right. You're going to be a school guy. Losers, you know. But I go to this predominantly white school, and there's kids that are cool, but they're also in AIG classes. And for me, it was always about seeing it as a system and saying, cool, how do I involve myself in the best way possible? How do I position myself in a way that I'm comfortable and I'm having fun and that I'm still proud of who I am? It was embarrassing to not make good grades for the first time there. And then that started sort of getting my brain going and feeling that little stimulus that you feel mm-hmm. when you're learning things and you're reacting to it. So that was interesting. That was a change for me to see that you could do both. As a person coming from a city, I was like code switch. You know, I didn't have that word for it then, but I was like, I can code switch. You know, I can do both. I can jump between the both. I don't have to be a nerd, but I could still, you know, but I could still do that and come back and do some of this too. And then we moved predominantly to a black school.
So there's three moves in the space of about 2 years.
Yeah, in all middle school. And then there I got to see another community and how they interacted and how I became part of that and how I maneuvered between that and a different sense of bullying or, you know, which for me, instead of seeing a lot of the differences, I started seeing a lot of similarities, those patterns of the cool kids and the not. And I just started being very much myself. By that, I mean kind of switching between the two and still making just grades good enough to, you know, feel good and feel proud, because I would definitely feel embarrassed, especially because I knew I had it in me, or I thought, or I was like, you know, I felt very able. Then after that, it was at Jordan Matthews, which is a pretty, probably equal diversity at the time when I was there.
That's a high school?
And that's a high school. And then I sort of felt like I had learned so much from these three different places, and I got to be in houses with country moms that would make racist jokes. You know,
What is that? So what is that experience like? You're in an environment where the constant code switching, first of all, was it taxing? Or did you even recognize it was a process you were doing, or was it just an automatic?
I didn't acknowledge it yet as such.
So it wasn't, I gotta survive, and I got Jerome here, and I got Maria here, and I got yep. Chad over there, yep. and Chance, and I
Bill
just...
Bill Johnson, Will Johnson, yeah.
I just got to make it through. So it wasn't taxing at all. But you get to these spaces where almost people forget Omar he's Mexican.
Yeah,
he has some sort of different perspective and feelings about things. So you're in the house, I don't know, you want to take Cindy out, and mom says what? Like, what is that like? And did you feel comfortable enough to kind of get back at them when they said it?
Honestly, I would just keep it inside and it would project itself later some other way. More than likely negative.
What kinds of things were being said? And how often are we talking about?
It was probably my first or second time that I would meet the parents. There would always be something said. Something about Mexican this, or even like wetback that. If I had some kind of misnomer about a word or in any colloquialism, they would want me to repeat it again. So they could laugh at me for getting it wrong. It was their little show, their personal show.
Yeah, true.
You know, the parents would be that way, but then I would look at John, and he's my loving friend, and he almost doesn't understand it. He doesn't get why his parents are so intimate, but he's laughing with them because they're his parents. And that definitely, I would just keep that inside. I definitely would later get into some small fights or things like that, and I'm sure that would be some kind of projection of that pent-up anger from those things.
Can you remember an incident where you almost didn't know, like, holy shit, what the hell did that, what happened to me? Where did I go? Like, mentally, where the hell did I go?
Yeah, in high school, I was playing tennis, and we were playing against
Mexican playing tennis? How dare you? What is wrong with you?
And I was looking for those things. I always wanted to be like, what should I not be doing? What's going to make somebody, not necessarily uncomfortable, but what am I not supposed to be doing? Where is there not an example of one of me there? Right. I want to go check that out. I want to see what that's about. And it was also more just about information, and I wanted to know more and see more and smell more, understanding that I could, where people would suggestively, without saying things, made you feel otherwise sometimes. Even to the point where I had counselors tell me not to take AP classes or honors classes.
But I can imagine these smaller communities, like you said, where, especially that second middle school you went to, where the white kids obviously were tracking a certain direction, and you recognize there's some value in that. I'm gonna start tracking in that direction. When you get some place where somebody looks at you and says, well, you look like this, so y'all probably don't wanna do this or go down this track. Do you buy into it at the point, or are you pushing back against it? Because it's tough to do that as a young person.
Yeah, for me, I pushed back immediately. I what I said was, well, can I? Can I technically register? You know, and they were like, well, yes, you can. Okay, then I want to do that. I think for me, it was a way to get back at what that parent said 5 years ago.
Right.
It's like, well, I'm going to do what you don't want me, or you don't expect me to, or if I'm not supposed to cross this line, I'm going to. Where I might not have academically been ready for that honors class. Not ready in the sense of my ability to cope with it and do well, but I just didn't have the study habits and sort of the expectation even from anybody else. For me, that became a challenge. From where I came, the way my mom brought me up was, you take that challenge and you tackle it.
So you did well in that?
Yeah, no, I did well. I did well enough, maybe B's. Yeah, even up to high school. And then I wasn't going to go to college. You know, I didn't expect.
Was that always part of the thought process? Mom wanted everybody to go pursue higher education?
Not necessarily. Mom wanted everybody to do the best they could do and just find a good job. And hopefully it's a job where they don't have to be physically as tired, or maybe there's upward mobility within that career.
What were some examples that you thought that she was steering you or your siblings towards? Because again, the prevailing thought about the Mexican-American community, they're the hardest workers, they're ready to work hard, you can't find anybody. So did you find that it was almost, okay, if I find a job, that's good, because that's what we do, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So I shouldn't even pursue higher education? Like, if I find a good, that's it, that's what we do. We work hard and we do that. Or was higher education always part of the thought process?
Mom would say, you know, just shoot for the stars. If on your way there you end up at the moon, that's still pretty far. So go for it. I think Mom was in such a survival mode and so busy with five kids by herself that she was really just doing her best to keep us motivated and hoping that we were smart enough to keep working at that.
Was Dad around?
No. Dad wasn't around since I was about 4 or 5 years old.
What did you learn in manhood?
We were lucky to have good uncles. We were lucky to have Mom bring us around community members that were great examples of human beings, but also men. I would look for it in even the redneck dad of my buddy. I would look for examples of manhood. Even now, I have a lot of friends that are in their 50s and 60s, and I'm a 30-year-old or 29-year-old, you know? I've always had that gravitation towards people a few generations or a generation beyond me, and understanding that there's a lot of value in that relationship.
Would you consider yourself an old soul?
Yeah, I think it's something that's part of me, but maybe also like you asked, maybe it's me also searching for that continued search for
father figure.
Father figure, yeah, or aspects of a father figure, and maybe that's me defending that, you know. Yeah, in other men.
What can you say about your mom now? Now that she's probably going to listen to this?
I'm very lucky to have a mother, and obviously every son's going to say that and should. But it's interesting. She would do things like, if she was making tortillas in the kitchen, and she'd be like, Omar, get over here and help me make tortillas. And she'd be like, hey, girls, y'all go find some firewood, because we're going to make a fire pit in the back, and that's where we're going to cook them. And I'd be like, Mom, why am I making tortillas? That's for girls. Mm-hmm. And she'd be like, okay, tell me why. Why is that for girls? Why can't your sisters go pick wood up? And this is from a woman that didn't even go to high school. It allowed me to value women, understand women, to look for a different type of understanding, to have a different sensibility, since I got to see a woman who was, to me, like, as physically strong as and as able as a man could be, from my understanding as a child, and capable, and would never admit otherwise to us, which was empowering to me. And through that, I've been able to perceive the world in a certain way that's really only given back in a good way.
So thanks, Mom.
Yeah,
gracias. Gracias, señorita.
Aviles.
Aviles, señorita Aviles. Let's go get them, Chad. Hey, 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 hey. Again, we're on the Ubuntu People's Podcast. I'm here with Mr. Omar Aviles. We've spoken about being in Chicago, moving to North Carolina, transitioning and navigating all the different social mores inside and outside of school. But I want to get to now kind of the connection that we made when we first started talking. You're in Hollywood, dog. You're out there in La La Land. So let me finish that first part of your life.
Yeah.
Graduate high school. You go to community college.
That's right, two years.
Two years.
I didn't plan on going out there any college at all, but my brother, older brother, through soccer, is playing in Wilmington in a community college. And, you know, we're on the phone and he says, well, Omar, at least try community college. You know, you're really good socially at school. He goes, Omar, there's fun. The fun doesn't stop there. There's all kinds of people here. And for me, it was, oh, more people to talk to, more people to see, more things to do. Okay. I remember being in one of my first classes in community college, and the professor just straight up saying, like, I get paid regardless of what grade you make. Whatever grade you make, I don't care. But I want to do a really good job and try. What you got? Show me what you got, little mama. Show me what you got, pretty lady. Show me what you got, shawty. Show me what you got, baby. Hands up and wave, and wave, and wave, and wave. Show me what you got, little mama. Show me what you got, pretty lady. Show me what you got, shawty. Show me what you got, baby. Hands up and wave, wave, and wave. Was it that teacher that kind of transformed it for you? Was it a certain subject matter that resonated with you that you were able to expand and see, well, all classes could be like that. Yeah. All education, all learning could be like that. Yeah, I think it was a bit of a combination. I think after having a little more faith in the system and letting myself absorb and take in and tackle that information, I just started seeing where else I could do that. But it definitely started with that subject of art. And then I was like, cool, let's take it to math and find my limit there. Let's take it to writing and argumentative writing and public speaking. And anytime somebody would be like, you could do this, I would sort of eat that up and just like start believing it. And at some point, Paul Quadros coming back to visit, said, Omar, you know you could go to UNC.
Tell people who Paul Quadros is. This is a remarkable story. You're part of that group?
Absolutely.
So yeah. What the? Yeah. Oh my God, I didn't even know this. So please, let's take a little side here. Just explain who Paul Quadros is and that whole story.
Right.
I didn't know this.
Yeah. Paul Quadros, as a freelance writer at the time, came to this town, this small town, and started a soccer program. And through that, ended up staying there to really continue it growing after he tried to, you know, get a soccer team going and was challenged by, I think it was a judge that was like, why don't you do something about it? So he did. You know, we were the first predominantly Hispanic team to win a state championship. That's after going through, years of wanting to get a program started in a community that was more focused on football and, you know, baseball, mm-hmm. and basketball, which is typical of the rural southern Bible Belt communities. And then winning a state championship, being welcomed, at least in that window, as representatives of the community, mm-hmm. in a positive way that we had not experienced before.
Were you a part of those teams?
Yeah, absolutely. I was, my oldest brother was part of the first generation. My second brother was part of the second generation.
Was there a movie made of, or there's a book?
Yeah, there's a book, Home on the Field.
Home on the Field.
That's right. And
was there talks about a movie? Was there a movie?
There still talks about a movie. There was a docuseries made. Just to fast forward a little bit and we'll come back. I end up graduating from Chapel Hill. I'm out for a year, kind of just trying to feel things out, doing odd jobs here and there. My mom gives me a check and says, you want to go in the industry? Go to LA. And I do it. I'm out there 3 weeks. I get a phone call from a director. Hey, Omar, this is Mark Landsman. We're doing a project in Siler City, North Carolina on this soccer team. It's a docuseries. You're a part of it. You know, Paul told us that you studied media. You have projects that you want to get started and going. Would you like to be an associate producer for us? So 3 weeks out there, I get sent back to Siler City for, was it 6 months, to work on something that I was a part of.
Obviously, graduate UNC, do the communication stuff. Mom gives you the check. She believes in you. You head out to LA. What are those first 3 weeks like? Because a lot of people have that dream, and I just wanted to get into that to see the reality of it. You don't know anybody out there. Did you know somebody? Are you crashing on a couch?
So I get off the plane, and I call a friend that I went to UNC with. They're like, yeah, you can crash at the couch. You know, while they're gone, I'm putting money together to do the whole ramen and eggs thing. And and then you hit the ground running every day. You wake up, you know.
Doing what? Specifically?
For me, it was just really looking for any job that was looking for any assistance in media. I was fortunate that it was only 3 weeks of that. For me, it still felt like a challenge. I wasn't reporting back sort of the tougher days to the family. I was like, I'm doing good out here. And I was really fortunate to have somebody that, you know, allowed me to be under the roof for a little while. Mm-hmm. Even after coming back from that job and after meeting and working 6 months with people that were actually from LA and promised like, hey, when you get back, we'll give you jobs. Give us a shout. You know, out of the five people that said that, four of them looked out. And so I started getting little jobs here, little jobs there, and then going on set and meeting a couple of other people, them kind of remembering me, them calling me for another job. Usually most assistant, what they call a PA, mm-hmm. And that's just assistant work. You know, anything from taking the trash bags out to making the coffee. Between that, learning as much as you could about, do I want to do this? Is that a thing for me? And then between all that, still trying to figure out how you're going to pay $1,200 a month for rent while having to still eat and do things. Definitely not an option to go out and have a beer or even have a drink or eat with anybody, which is fine. For me, that wasn't something I was focused on. I was just trying to, cool, let's get grinding, let's get working. Very much about the grind, and people work 16-hour days together, so it comes down to attitude. Somebody would rather have somebody that has a good attitude and is willing to learn than somebody who already knows their job and thinks they know it all and just gonna be a pain in the ass the whole day for 16 hours. I'd rather have that person that has a good attitude. I noticed that, and that's just who I am anyway, so I, you know, would just stick with it and hope that efforts would be acknowledged. And sometimes they would, sometimes they wouldn't be, but just picking and pulling and playing that long game.
I like the word that you used, the phrase that you used, the long game. I'm not going to take it personal, kind of like, you know, the teachers at the community college. That's just the reality.
Yeah.
And the reality, I think, behind the scenes, specifically in the movie industry, is those relationships and being able to navigate those relationships. Obviously, we've seen the last couple of years where men in power are using their power to abuse the possibilities in those relationships sexually and things like that. But when you are in an environment where somebody is spending 6 months with you, it might not be what you know. It's just, dude, I can't stand you. You might be the genius, but I'm not going to 6 months in Costa Rica in the jungle to film this shit, and you're a pain in the ass just talking about bullshit all the time. I think what you learned, at least you said, learned in middle school, being able to navigate with the cholos, with the white guys, with the mom who might be semi-racist, doesn't even know it, and then just kind of have that stuff deflect off your back because the long game is more important.
said mama.
How is it to navigate that aspect, knowing that you're in an industry where reputation is everything, where it's not necessarily the work you're doing, but it's, like you said, the attitude and how you're navigating the relationships of all the people that are helping you do the work or might be hindering from doing the kinds of work that you want to do?
That environment can be used in a couple of different ways. I think people that are looking for power over others can weaponize it and then try to intimidate crew members and talent. I have a really good example of that. As a PA on a Pharrell Williams music video called Freedom, there's a mall, torn down mall that they're doing this music video in, not working escalators. So there's people on the second floor, first floor. I'm pushing this cart from probably the camera guys. I hear somebody yelling like, hey, no, don't go past that line. I'm like, oh, I didn't see it. This person keeps yelling at me from up there. And we have walkies that we're supposed to use. There's a certain etiquette about it. After he continued badgering me, after I had already listened to his instruction, I said, I can't hear you. Use your walkie. He feels really offended. Goes to the assistant director, which is actually some of what I do now. The assistant director chooses to call me up in front of a crew of 40, maybe. And I'm like, I've been to the office before. That's okay. I know what's going on. I come up and he's like, this person is such and such. They've done this and that. And I said, I'm just reciprocating the respect that was given to me. We have walkies. This is how I was taught to use walkies. He wasn't doing that. He was like a lead man for his department. And I'm angry, but I've learned to manage and control myself.
ISS.
So I'm not going to apologize to this person for belittling me. And the person's back there behind the AD, like putting his hands on his arms, like you're about to get scolded. And I said, I'm actually not comfortable in this environment. That breaks my contract. If you could please let me finish my day. It was a 9-day shoot. If you could please let me finish my day, I'd really appreciate that. I'm really passionate about my work. And the AD goes, Omar, no argument about that. You're keen on set. So after that, on my way down, the anger is starting to pour out a little bit. So what I do to control it is I just smile on my way down. Everybody's staring at me, And another PA goes, Omar, why are you smiling? I said, because I have self-respect, really loud. And Pharrell Williams is walking in at that time. He looks over and asks, and I said, nope, I'm just a work day. And I keep doing, and I usually have long hair, so, I already had long hair at the time. I had my hair pulled up really professional behind camera. At the end of the day, I was just trying to show off a little, so I let my hair down, and I'm trying to wrap that day up as best I can, like not to do a bad job and just leave set, but to do the best job I can to let them know that I'm a professional. The next day, I get a call from management, and they say, Pharrell and his people heard about it. They say, hey, Omar, what's your day rate as an actor on set? One of the guys that I worked with knew that I did talent work, and somehow got around, like you said, word traveled. Mm-hmm. They bring me back on set for an undisclosed amount that for me was more than, I ever got paid for any talent work. Mm-hmm. The director lines me up in front of the person that belittled me, and says, could you move out of the way? I need to see Omar from head to toe.
Get the hell out.
Gives me a little wink. He says, Omar, you're perfect. And then sends me on to do this shot where I have a hawk flying off my arm with no shirt and jeans for this Freedom video. I had to hold back and not be immature. And so, we go through the day and I can just tell the AD's super angry and making passive aggressive comments, but I don't feed into what he's trying to do. I have a lot of respect for Pharrell and his team and the director to really look out and to make a point of someone defending themselves on set and not letting themselves be belittled. That's a good story. There aren't many of those out there.
Hold on to me, don't let me go. Who cares what they see? Who cares what they know? Your first name is free, last name is dumb. But you still believe.
But
so it's Hollywood racist.
They see green. That involves racism based on the system and how it's been running for years. It has supported racism. I wouldn't say it's graying the line yet, but it sees green. They want eclectic and exotic people. For me, I get to LA and I'm like, okay, this is the biggest Mexican-American communities that exist. Why are there not more people, not in front of camera? I can understand, I get where that's at, whether I'm happy or not with it. But why are there not more people behind the camera just working, right? Like, we've been here for years. Like, how is it that kids didn't grow up in high school trying to get themselves into the industry and doing it? Why am I seeing Uruguayans, Aussies, Australian people, British people? They're working behind camera more than anybody else. I do a lot of documentary work, and that's honestly fed my soul a lot. They might not be making the commercial money, but they've made it a life goal to be in the industry, feeding part of their soul and what they do in a beautiful way. And I've been lucky to fix myself into that, and people like Mark Lansman, Guy Mossman, who worked in Los Jets, really opened me up to. So I've been very lucky to be able to jump from advertising gigs that could be a little more rigid and harsh, and not in racial ways, just in the fast-paced in and out turnaround, because, okay, let's get them all 25 and 30. As soon as they're getting burned out, let's get the next 25-year-old, because this guy's getting burned out. He's going to start giving us trouble now and start thinking about 401ks and interest and stocks. We don't want to hear that. Get the other guy that's not thinking about that and is willing to not sleep that well again. You know, so it's a machine. It's a machine, and it runs that way. Being more of a realist as I share things, not to push people away, but to give individuals a sense of playing that long game. We're making TV out there, man. Like, we're not curing cancer. We're making TV, you know? Nobody needs to belittle anyone. We're making television. It's awesome.
What do you like to watch? From somebody who's been on the backside, who sees the amount of work it takes to get this particular product. In terms of production, you go, man, they're doing it right.
You've got Donald Glover. He works in Atlanta. It talks about internal issues with the African-American community. Mm-hmm. For me, that's beautiful.
Yeah, is there a Latinx example out there?
The Latinos I can think of, specifically the Mexicans that I can think of, are Eugenio Derbez, Cuarón, the director, you know, Guillermo del Toro. Mm-hmm. These guys, they're not Mexican-American. They're Mexicans doing a lot in the industry to provide opportunities for a lot of other Latinos, but they came from not necessarily well-to-do environments, but environments with good resources, right. And I'm so glad they're there. I'm incredibly happy that they still have the ability to share stories that aren't from their privileged world, but, you know, for example, like Roma just recently came out, right? There are stories that come from the everyday communities and the everyday struggle, and they do really well, almost as if they came from that. Mm-hmm. You know, Robert Rodriguez is probably the only Mexican-American I can think of, has a really interesting wheelhouse of work, right? He's done things like A Spy Kid, Sin City. He started off with a movie, Mariachi, all by himself. He's the only Mexican-American that I can think of, and I'm sorry you guys out there, that you're like, well, I'm out here, check my workout. I've been kicking butt too. Maybe that says something too. I could complain about that, or I can say, well, there's room. There's room for our content. How do we get it out there? How do we get it going? Being behind in front of the camera, who else do I get involved with? That doesn't necessarily have to be Latino. I'm very aware of not excluding. I think that can be dangerous. It's like seeing somebody at a Latino march and telling the black person or the white person that's in that front row to, no, let more Hispanics in the front. Why not show that there's solidarity between the differences? And those subtleties, I think the youth really picks up. So for me, that's super important to note.
So you said you noticed that behind the camera, there were Brits, there were Aussies, there were other folks, yeah. Not Latinos, and that does seem interesting because there's such a big population right there in LA.
I've started to run into guys that are just graduating college, that media is their interest, and they're going out there and starting in some of the PA positions or associate producer positions. There's definitely a coming wave of it. There are inspired young cats out there, you know, that hopefully jump the gun and get beyond me.
What else have you done out there?
Like I said, I started off as a production assistant, which is just like essentially you do everything that nobody wants to do. I've done associate producing, which is essentially coordinating for the producer between hiring and the day and what's needed and how to, you know, manage people and paperwork and, you know, ADing, assistant director. That's essentially the person that deals with all of the technical aspects of the day to get it going. So, hey, makeup, 15 minutes before we get into wardrobe. Hey, wardrobe, you're going to have five.
So what is the director doing then? Just cut?
The director's sitting on that chair ready to make that dream come to life.
Okay.
And he can't be distracted with organizational things. Typically can't be distracted with things that are about organization or, hey, this makeup person's having trouble finding the type of colors that they didn't bring because we didn't tell them.
So your job is to figure all that stuff out. So are you having daily, like a morning brief with the director?
Yeah, typically there's a pretty thorough pre-production setup where your showrunner and your coordinator bring things to the forefront so that you can be ready to handle that. They've honestly done all of the preparation to make sure that things don't go wrong, but it's a set. Something will always go wrong. You're there with all of that information that's been prepared for you, you know, and the companies and the caterers that already came. You have essentially moving pieces. It does take a village to really get it going. You're building something, but you need somebody that gets to point and
he's the badass on set? Or she?
Yeah, but you can, yes, but you also take the blunt. If somebody gets hurt, they can detain you until they figure it out. Like, the cops might come and detain you until it's figured out.
So there's no liability for the director. It goes straight to the AD?
Yeah, no, the director tries to stay away from that with the idea that they're there to make that vision go through and that's their job. They're also responsible for it, that vision to go through. At the end of the day, in the editing room, if they don't have a piece of content that they should, it's because that director didn't make sure it happened. You know, mm-hmm. He wasn't there. He forgot about it. He didn't ask for them to do that third take when he knew that they needed to have that specific reaction and he didn't do it. Then it goes down to him. That's in post. But while we're shooting, it comes down to the AD, your assistant directors, your first and second ADs, so it's staggered, and it's really teamwork. So that's why you want a good attitude. That's why you want to have people that are going to help you figure stuff out.
The last name is always executive producer. That's the top.
Yeah.
Even above the director, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Because you see these things all the time, but then yeah, I want to make sure anybody who's listening, like, what's the staircase, if you would. Because it doesn't sound like you were concerned with technical things as an AD. So when does that come into play? Like, when do you make that jump?
That's when the show wraps and there's an after party. You better make sure you're going to that thing. You better make sure that the only opportunity you're going to have a conversation with the director or the creatives, as they call it, you can do it. And you can do it while having a beer. Or maybe you can do it while not having a beer, but let them know that you can hang mentally, socially, and that you get it. And then they'll be like, hey, do you want to come by and check our readings out? Meaning that, okay, we're actually going to bring into the part of the story being written. Or, hey, they might ask for your opinion the next time. But it's really a long shot from AD. A lot of it comes from the writer and director world. There's some cross-sectionality there. People that write and become directors. Executive producers come from a little bit of everywhere. Some of them come from working really hard as creatives. But mostly it comes from people that understand the business and understand the consumer market in a way that they can bet on.
So the main job is to go get the money?
To go get the money, okay. Or sometimes they already have the money. They're making the high-risk bet, vetting the director for his vision and saying, make it happen. We believe in this. We think that this is going to either be just good and it's worth the risk, or there's been the pattern of this type of consumerism for this type of genre of content. People are commenting on it in this way. Let's make that change. That to me makes a good executive producer.
The keyword is green, and you talk about if you want to jump up to the next level, whatever your long-term vision is, and being able to hang in those after parties or those social events, you know, having a conversation, being strategic.
Absolutely.
Buddy, buddy.
Yeah.
You can then see it's those situations where, like you said, it's not racism. It's just what people know and what people bring into those rooms, bring into those parties, and the expectations they have where, well, that black guy or that Mexican is going to want to talk about this. I don't know anything about Cholo. I don't know anything about Tyler Perry movies, so I'm not going to. Whereas the guy on the other side is going, I don't even like Tyler Perry. Like Toro or Cuarón, I was born in middle class in Mexico City, dude. I went to college. I've been making movies since I was 15 because my parents could afford it. So it's that thing where you see where those patterns keep repeating. So must there be just constant affirmative action for like 150 years until the patterns get so ingrained in the other direction? And then obviously you can have people on the other side going, that's racist, that's giving favoritism. But it doesn't seem like it's ever going to change unless there's that purposeful effort for it to.
At least for a certain amount of time, it's important to open that door wide open. I think creativity, content, will weed out the individuals within that don't have it or are bringing things up that aren't going to draw the attention of anyone else. That person won't make it too long. There's a self-regulating system there that we shouldn't fear as content creators and as filmmakers. I'm sure there are people that and individuals and genres that fear those approaches, but I think they should welcome it. Worst case scenario, they learn more from how to make their content different or how to adjust their content, who to invite in to help you with that content in a respectful way. even if you're making fun of things. I recently worked on drunk history for the Native American occupation of Alcatraz in the 1950s, and I'm an extra, so very humble, like the lowest interactive position, but it was really interesting. I can't remember the director's name, but I really enjoyed the way that he had consultants for the Native American community while obviously being very jovial and enjoying misrepresenting parts of that story being told. The way this director and the whole crew worked was so comfortable and fun, and we were all laughing together. Nobody was needing to look over their shoulder, even if they weren't Native American, felt like they had to look over their shoulder. There was a They were just doing it right, man. People were having fun and everybody was comfortable.
Do you find that most of the things you've been working on in the past 3.5 years have been progressive?
I'd say for the most part, yes. Some of it's been reinforced by the reactions that we individuals and consumers have had. Whether it's been reinforced by that, it should come more naturally. But for now, I'll take it. Please keep making us feel like we need to take a harder look at what we do. Those individuals that claim that it makes it more difficult to them to create content that they typically would and would be enjoyable, and now they feel disrupted by this wave of people yelling and shouting about everything they feel offended about, you're neglecting the opinion of the color wheel that and the kaleidoscope that you yourself would love as a creator. I think those people, like I said, they'll weed out eventually as well.
The part they never get is that marginalized folks have always pushed back against that since the beginning of cinema. Nobody cared what we thought about Birth of a Nation or the way Black or Latina people were portrayed in movies as this or that. Nobody cared. So now we have the spending power and the demographics of the country are changing, where economically, because Hollywood thinks green, you gotta care.
That's right.
And it's not my fault that you then have to not change your creative process, but get used to that reality, dog. Just get used to that reality. You're now writing for folks on the color wheel who were being ignored, but they're paying green. It is what it is, man. This is the 21st century. This is America moving forward. Get on board. So with that, man, what's the plan? So you've been out there 3.5 years. When we talk to you again in like 5 years, where are we gonna see you?
Well, hopefully you'll actually be able to see more of me in front of the camera, as well as creatively. I primarily work with Gavin Dugan with Big Gumption Productions, and I'm very lucky to work with him mostly between all of my freelancing. That's in documentary or narrative. BigGumptionProductions.com, you should see a lot of it. That deals with a lot of different communities in the U.S., anything from Samoan, Native American, all kinds of, Latino. And I would say to anybody going out there and that sees a lot of these things that may be discouraging, you'll find somebody out there. Just stick to your guns, find people that have like interest, and allow yourself to be empowered and empower yourself to keep making work. It's a battlefield, it can be, but the rewards are there, and once you get that threshold, you can inspire others.
Well, Mr. Omar Aviles, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us on the Ubuntu People's Podcast. Story is interesting, man, as most people's stories are. Once we take the time to sit down and talk, so I appreciate you giving me that opportunity. I'll definitely be looking out. We got to see you on the screen somewhere.
Yeah.
We will be looking out, man. Thank you.
Your first name is King. Last name is Dumb. Because you still believe in everyone. Breathing.